Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What does it mean when we put the two words together, design leadership? Are they in opposition to each other, or are they actually, do they work in harmony?
Ultimately, I think it's worthwhile understanding that whenever we put two things together, a third thing emerges, and that it's up to us to explore different variations of that relationship. So for me, design has a specific meaning and leadership has a specific meaning, and together they create, if anything, a greater opportunity beyond what I think we've currently understood.
Hello and welcome to another episode of This Is HCD. I'm delighted to have you with me for another cracking episode. As many of you will probably know, my name is Jerry Scullion and I'm a service designer based in Ireland, and I offer service design training, user experience design training, and also my visualization methods for Changemakers course on my website, and I offer this course in-house for businesses too. So if you're in an organization and looking for training, please do get in touch with me. I'm recording this segment from Spain, where I'm on a long overdue vacation with my family, so if the audio quality of the intro is a little bit questionable, that'll be why. Anyway, today in the show, I speak with Sarah Clearwater about design leadership, a white paper that she instigated, curated, and spoke to with many people across various organizations, mainly in the APAC region. Sarah's based in New Zealand, and I'll drill deeper into the background of the paper, where it originated from, and what questions they ultimately sought to answer. Now, I really want to get more into the different perspectives of what we mean by design and leadership. And we speak about it so often, but really, what do we mean by this? I fully believe in what we are trying to achieve by discussing design and leadership. Now, the question is this ultimately or actually achievable in certain organizations? Sarah was a great guest, and I think you'll enjoy the perspective. So let's jump straight in. So, Sarah Clearwater, I'm delighted to have you on the podcast. We've been back and forth for a couple of months, and I'm excited to have you here. So maybe start off, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and where you're from.
Sure. Thank you, Jerry. Great to be here today with you. I am originally from West Berlin. I'm born to East German and Egyptian parents, and I sort of grew up towards the end of the Cold War into a very new type of Germany, I suppose. I always like to describe myself as an intersection child, because if you imagine West Berlin in the 80s, I guess you can imagine a great diversity of sort of sociocultural movements, different economic structures, different politics, different ways of living and thinking and being. And so I'm always attracted to the spaces in between, which I put down to my upbringing, I suppose.
Your background. So you're in New Zealand now. Like, we can't ignore the Kiwi accent, and I'm going to do my very best not to do Flight of the Conchords jokes in this episode. But how long have you been in New Zealand?
And so I came to New Zealand twice, first in 2011 and then again in 2016. I met a Kiwi while living in the UK, and as we all know, London doesn't really have any English people in it. It's mainly Aussies, Kiwis, a bunch of Saffirs, and then the odd other European. And of course I had to come across one of the Kiwis and decide that, you know, he was the one I was going to follow. So here we are.
So whereabouts in New Zealand are you now?
So I'm living in Auckland now.
Okay, you're in Auckland. Great city. I was there a couple of years ago. On our way out of Australia, we stopped in Auckland for a couple of weeks, which was really great. But I notice over the last couple of years, you've been working primarily as a CX consultant. So the name of your business is CX Collective, correct?
That's one of them, yes.
Okay. So talk me through, because we're going to be discussing one of the reports that you created and you sent through about design leadership in a second. But I'm interested to see about your own personal journey on how you landed into the world of CX and, you know, what your involvement is with human-centered design as well.
Sure. I would say that like I think many of my peers or people who call themselves designers today, most of us have actually arrived here by chance rather than by design, ironically. And so I first, I first trained as a policy analyst, as a human systems analyst, effectively. I studied in the Netherlands, got a humanities degree, partly to explain, you know, to myself, I think, how a world this diverse could possibly coexist. You know, I had this notion that if we can figure out how we can create sort of or co-create policy for, you know, 28 different countries with multiple different languages and social systems and traditions and views of the world, that, you know, anything is possible. So I went into this really full of curiosity and full of sort of hunger to better understand how we can create unity out of diversity, how we can live next to each other but still be who we are. And I guess through that, I then moved to the UK, started working for the local government association there, and got really stuck into policy as a change mechanism, if you will. Okay. And it's probably there that for the first time I really came across what we would now start to identify as co-design, sort of, you know, engaging with citizens, like having conversations with them, co-designing with other stakeholders across the policy spectrum, across different different local government agencies, and then moving to New Zealand. Well, there wasn't that much around European level policy that was really relevant here. And so most of my experience didn't have an anchor. And through that, I got into community engagement. I got into qualitative research, which then got me across to, I guess, what we now call probably design research, and through that into design.
Okay, so you've had a long and winding road, to quote the Beatles, to this point where you're at now in your career. So what brought you to creating this report, the Design Leadership Report? I think it's called Perspectives on Design and Leadership, is that right?
That's the one, Jerry. Good memory. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm cheating. I have it on my screen here. But yeah, you created, you can sort of see the hint of the orange glow coming from this screen over here where all my notes are. But I do, I did remember it anyway. But what was the kind of precursor to the creation of this report?
Sure. So I think, and this is possibly a sort of New Zealand-centric view of looking at design, but something that I've observed over the last sort of 5 to 6 years being in the industry is that we keep having the same conversations and bump up against the same challenges without much iteration or evolution. A lot of designers are really focused on working in the practice, and I haven't come across many people who are interested or practicing design who actually work on our practice. And as a result, I have a sense that we're not really evolving or maturing with great intent as a discipline. Rather, we sort of haphazardly jump into the work, trying to get as much good design work done and, you know, uplift the experiences for our communities and our customers and our colleagues without any sort of robust discourse on where design is going. And through some of that, I guess, frustration or, really frustration, I thought I better have a chat to some people, because that's what we do as designers, right? We don't just form an opinion, we start being explicit about our assumptions and then lean into that conversation.
You definitely had a lot of conversations. Like, there's some people here that I would know of. I don't know, I'm going to do a quick count up. 8, 16, was it 20 people? How many was it? 24 people?
We had 28 conversations in total.
28 conversations. And like, they're not people who are unfamiliar with what we mean by design leadership. There's some serious organizations here in the APAC region, like Optimal Workshop, I know Kelsey, and a number of others there, Zero and so forth. So question for you, what does it mean when we put the two words together, design leadership? Are they in opposition to each other, or are they actually, do they work in harmony?
So I think, I mean, great question. Ultimately, I think it's worthwhile understanding that whenever we put two things together, a third thing emerges. And it's up to us to explore different variations of that relationship. So for me, design has a specific meaning and leadership has a specific meaning, and together they create, if anything, a greater opportunity beyond what I think we've currently understood.
So there's really when I think about leadership, I think about people who are guiding the ship, who are kind of like laying the foundations for the future and kind of getting people to, you know, work alongside each other for a common goal. And I'm keen to see and understand a little bit more around what you learned about leadership within the design sphere. And what are the bits that are holding back the practice of design being embedded into organizations?
So I want to take a step back before I dive into leadership and maybe offer a view on what's happening for designers inside organizations and why leadership is such an important thing for us to lean more deeply into. So I think one thing that I'm observing in a sort of consulting role is that I come into organizations and design teams are really excited about the fact of doing better design, right? They want to upskill their capability, they want to get more hands on deck, they want to really make lives better for people. I think many designers really have this notion or this idealism behind them, which is wonderful. And when they do that, the common assumption I'm seeing is that in order to get better outcomes, we have to do better designs. What I'm observing instead is that in order for design outcomes to actually show up and to be more impactful, we need to start leaning into intentionally driving change inside the organization. Because if there's one thing I think that I'm seeing is that design fundamentally, or the promises of design, are fundamentally different to the dominant business narratives we are encountering. And so if we're designing in a commercial context, we're coming with all these beliefs around lived experience, human-centered ways of making decisions, of showing up, of seeing the world, and we bump up against the commercial realities of many of those organizations. So, and then talking to leaders as part of this report, what I'm hearing is that leadership is independent of design. Right, leadership is its own practice. Leadership ultimately is about creating the conditions for, in our case, the design team to thrive. But I've talked to leaders who aren't designers and who are still very, very good at that. So when we think about the traditional trajectory of a designer moving from junior to intermediate to senior to leader, we assume that is someone with subject matter expertise who is maturing in their practice. When in actual fact, the person sitting in the leadership position or the functional leadership role within an organization doesn't have to be a designer, because the job is fundamentally different.
Yeah. So is like you mentioned there about designers wanting to do better work. Okay. What are the blockers enabling that? Is it you saying it's a leadership piece? Are you saying that leadership needs to become more aware of their impact on the designers?
I'm saying that designers need to figure out what their innate leadership capacity is, depending on where they are.
Designers,
right?
So walk me through that. So what does that look like from the perspective of leaders who are already in place, and then you've got a swarm of designers who are figuring out that they potentially have leadership? How does this work?
So I would agree with you that someone who sits in the functional leadership role is ultimately there to create the conditions, the structures, right, to provide a level of guidance and direction. But so far we've assumed that is that person who is leading in every aspect of the word. They're not just leading the function, they're leading the conversations, they're leading the meetings, they're leading the practice, they're leading our career development. They're responsible for all of that.
But they're also leading sales and marketing and operations, and it's the whole design centric versus impact centric approach to to kind of where design sits within the organization. The complexity, and I mean the proper term of complexity as of leadership, is it's really difficult. The problems are really difficult. They're all interconnected. But is the problem designers not becoming leaders? Is that the problem? I'm keen to understand what that might look like from a leadership perspective if you had that group of designers all kind of, what are they striving for? Are they striving to become business leaders, like leaders of the business, like CEOs or COOs? Or are they just, are we talking about design leadership?
I think when we talk about design leadership in the context of design practice, we're talking about our ability to connect our craft with our context. We're talking about our ability to connect our work with the impact it's trying to create. And we're talking about intentionally and actively stepping into spaces of discomfort that ask of us to hold two truths. One, right, that we are designing for people, and that is, you know, that lived experience and sort of people's feelings and their needs have a role to play or should play a role in our decision making within an organization, as well as working for an organization that has commercial aspirations and that will, when it comes down to it, will make a decision based on bottom line and profitability and efficiency and productivity. They are two competing worldviews that are true at every moment in time. And if we want to achieve impact with our practice, the leadership ask, no matter of our role within the system, within the organization, is to straddle and navigate that tension.
Yeah.
What someone in a functional leadership role does is doing that at a much more senior level and therefore at a greater level of complexity and a greater level of risk, right? Yeah. And at a greater level of exposure.
Yeah.
And if I can just add an example to that, when we are leading at a functional level, we are leading into the executive, we're leading into our peers of other managers and sort of heads off.
Yeah.
When we're leading at a practice level as a practicing designer, we're leading into other teams, other silos, we're leading into conversations, into stories, into meetings, always straddling that tension. And we're shying away from that, I think.
Those tensions, I want to understand a little bit more. They tend to be, in my experience, and tell me you've got more sort of clarity on this, is the kind of the incessant need for growth and economic success, okay? And what tends to be a blocker from a design perspective is they want to add value to the customers or the person who's using the service, their lives. And sometimes that's unquantifiable from a business perspective in terms of like, what is the ROI in this? Why are we doing this? So that's one of the key tensions between the typical, I'm doing air quotes here, folks, leadership versus design leadership. And it's balancing those. It's kind of like, okay, you win this one, but I'll come for you again in another few weeks with another one. You pick your battles.
You have to, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Because it is a relationship at the end of the day. So what are the other tensions that you were seeing other than the commercial aspects?
Well, I think a really massive challenge is how do you participate, partake, and add value to a system that at the same time you're trying to change, right? So, and that is related to the previous tension, but a separate activity. How do I? Yeah, 100%. And it's slightly schizophrenic, right? Like, how do I demonstrate value, as you said, in my role and my capacity as a designer, when I know that my allegiances are divided and that my mandate is to remind the business that they have appointed me because they wanted me to have multiple allegiances?
Yeah. Yeah, when we're talking about this stuff, and when I read the report, I remember the pieces where I was reflecting on. I was like, well, there's two kind of operational pieces within the design piece. There's the craft piece, as in, like, you've got the conditions to create, you know, the best possible outcomes when we're designing. And if you liken, or if this is akin to a chef in a kitchen, the chef is producing, you know, beautiful meals, they're being satisfied and stuff, but at the same time, the knives and the plates and the crockery and everything that's used to cook the food is not fit for purpose. That's a separate job. You would almost look at the manager to work co-creatively with the chef to create a better outcome. So in our worlds, and I love the fact that, you know, schizophrenic might be the right word, but I get what we're trying to say here in terms of, like, if a leadership is sitting in a meeting with a designer or design leadership, and they're like, okay, we've managed to create these outcomes under poor conditions. They're like, what poor conditions? We need you to fix those. So suddenly now there's two jobs. You're being graded on creating quality outcomes, you know, great dishes, continue the analogy of the chef. And two, also make sure you can fix up the kitchen so it's fit for purpose. That takes us away. And the bit that I want to talk to you a little bit more around, it takes us away from the bit that we're being paid to do, really. And that is to create better outcomes. And as a result, if we can't put our full focus on this, the outcomes are going to be depleted.
That's right.
So what I want to understand a little bit more, and I really liked the way you broke down the three categories. You know, design as a behavior, design as a practice. And what was the third one? I'm going to have to do a bit of scrolling here, folks. Design as a
function.
Function. Now, the bit that I wanted to talk to you a little bit more around was design as a craft. Because I'm still of the opinion that we are still craftspeople at the end of the day. What was the thinking behind that? And was it an intentional omission?
So craft emerged from an understanding and a view of the diversity of disciplines, the diversity of knowledge, and the diversity of experience that feeds into the design practice today. So, yeah. You know, as someone who is a scientist, can someone who's a scientist call themselves a designer? Can someone who is an anthropologist or a doctor or a nurse or, you know, is that compatible? And if you look across our industry, you'll find people from all walks of life suddenly having that designer title. And I think in the report, I distinguish between design as a behavior, which is, you know, a trait of all living things, to design as a practice, which is where these days we talk about the design discipline or design thinking, human-centered design showing up in organizations, and design as a function, which is which I'm referring to as the functional role of leading a team of designers within an organization. And the leadership element straddles the practice as well as the function. And the craft is what many people are attracted to when they come to design, right? We all started out with the attraction to the possibility of creating solutions or solving problems or producing outcomes that make the world a better place in some shape or form. Now, the massive disconnect between design practice and design and functional design leadership is when we are suddenly disconnected from our tools, right? And you hear that from every single person who has been a designer, a practicing designer, and then moved into a functional design leadership role, where they are missing the tools. And many go back because they can't, their identity is tied to practicing it, right?
Yeah.
And so that's one thing, is recognizing that design leadership in the functional sense has got very little to do with doing design and very much to do with creating the conditions for design to thrive. And a lot of that is difficult, is political, is banging your head against the door and waiting for it to open and still keeping going, building resilience, creating momentum in that team, and holding space for that team to sometimes grieve that straddle that we talked about, that tension, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes to harness the energy that comes from friction to propel the team forward, which is a very different job. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the problems within design, I feel, is the label of design, because lots of people have multiple meanings for what we mean by design. I still get asked, do I design Aran sweaters? And I'm like, it's a type of jumper in Ireland. And I'm like, no, I'm not that kind of designer. Oh, do you do interiors? No, I don't. What do you do? Services. What's a service? Okay, well, let's get the whiteboard out. And I'm like, kids, go get the whiteboard. Daddy's going to talk about what he does for a living. Anyway, one of the pieces I want to talk to you a little bit more around is design operations. Okay, design operations and design leadership. The phrase design operations, I love. I absolutely like it. It's got a deep kind of satisfaction for me because it's moving laterally away from the design definition. And it's very descriptive of what it is we need to do. Operations, the operational parts of design, creating those conditions. Design leadership, what I want to understand is how do these conflict, or do they mean the same thing in your eyes? Because when you talk about design functional, and you talk about, I'm trying to remember here, the three, give me a second, don't jump in. It's design behavior and design practice. So when you think about those three things, a lot of those encompasses design operations. So they're considering those aspects. Do we still need design leadership if we've got design operations?
That's a good question. I would say that design leadership still provides the umbrella under which all of this comes together, right? Still provides the direction and, most importantly, the anchor. Design leadership is outward looking, I think, and design operations, it's inward looking.
Yeah,
and so the two are almost the two parts, you know, of the same chain link type thing. And I would say that a good design operations lead will be one of the biggest assets to any design leader out there today.
Yeah, they work in harmony, I guess.
Ideally.
So when you look at other disciplines, when I'm taking the perspective from a leadership perspective, if you're sitting in the middle of the organization, it could be a product leadership, it could be CEO or COO, even a CFO, and you see, I'm walking over to the sales department and we've got the head of sales and we've got a sales director. And then we go over to the marketing, we've got a marketing director, and then we might have head of marketing, and we might have other types of marketing, direct marketing and so forth. And they come over to the design team, and then you've got, hi, I'm the design operations head, and then I'm the design leader, and then I'm the UX leader, and then I'm the service design leader. What does that look like in terms of when we're talking about actual business leaders, the COOs, COOs? Are we being overcomplicated about these things, the nuances around what we do, or can organizations get by? Like, what do you say to those people who are like, okay, the designers are just kind of going around in circles here? They're not really solving business problems.
So I think the fundamental challenge that we have as designers inside organizations is that we are the new kid on the block, right? Sales and marketing and finance has been around in a commercial setting for a very long time. And so we are building the plane as we're flying it, right? Yep. We don't have a accreditation that we go through. You must do these five things and now you shall be a designer. Like, it's not like, you know, go to university and get a marketing degree or get a sales qualification. And I think the other thing that's really important for us to understand is that design, unlike many other disciplines, anchors in the human condition. So what that means is that our practice and our ability to evaluate if we're practicing well is deeply context dependent. If we, one set of design practices and principles would not be fit for purpose in a different context. One of the most evident differences we have been observing in the last few years is sort of the separation of human-centered design and co-design or participatory practices, right? Yeah. They've gone different ways, although we share a root, I guess, belief system, because of the context within which we're practicing has asked much, much different things of our practices, right? And so when you say we've got all these different people, do we even solve business problems? Like, they're two different questions, right? We internally within our team, we need a level of complexity because we're not just flying the plane. We're also building it. And we're also figuring out where we're going, and that we may need that to build a robust practice.
Yeah. Right?
If we're solving business problems, is then evidenced by our ability to link our craft with our context and tell the right stories and build the right relationships. And I think that, to your first question, really is where leadership shows up. And so I think the key things that this report has uncovered, which I found really, really insightful, is that when you look at leadership through a lens not of function but of practice or behavior, what shows up is leadership as a moment in time that is observable by others that any of us can step into. Mm-hmm. And when we think about leadership not as an omnipresent status, as a decision we make based on our unique abilities and preferences and skills to step into particular situations and lead there, right? And when I say lead there, what I mean by leadership in that context is the ability to see a different future, a future that is different from today, and then take steps towards that. Any of us has the ability to look what's in front of us and say something else could be better, and we can then take steps into that direction. And when we talk about a team leading collectively, the challenge of the quote-unquote functional design leader becomes to create a level of consistency and coherence across the leadership activity within the team. But a leader alone can't move across a 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people organization and expect an emergent practice to just show up and deliver value.
Yeah.
Like, that is unbelievably exhausting and frankly inadequate to ask of a single person. It is about the construction and the conduction, like a conductor, if you will, to align all of these through various mechanisms, and for each of us to take responsibility and accountability in our unique spaces and step into leadership where we can in alignment with others.
Absolutely. And absolutely, I see that. The questions I'm asking are the questions that I've been thrown in the last year or two, like around design leadership. What does it mean for, COOs, CEOs, when, there's multiple design leaders floating around the business, and they go, who does what? Why are they here? What are they bringing to the organization? There's no question there's value in terms of what they're creating. It's more what gets used. And from the leadership perspective, there's a level of curation that happens whenever the design leaders present visions to the future. And it's ultimately like Game of Thrones, where the one who, succeeds is the one who stands the longest and, says the same thing repeatedly over time, or is a change of leadership. So a lot of the stuff that we're talking about here requires designers to change. What does it look like from the perspective of leaders to kind of become more receptive to the work that design leaders as a function are creating? What are your thoughts on that?
So when you talk about leaders, you're talking about other leaders in the business.
CEOs, heads of marketing, heads of sales. Well, what does that look like? Because that in particular, I'm coaching a couple of people in financial services at the moment. They are hitting their heads against a wall in terms of trying to sell why they need to get experienced designers into the organization. But leadership just, have a deaf ear. They don't want to hear these problems. They don't have the power themselves to maybe increase the budgets. They and it's a really sort of complicated space to be in when you're in that situation. What do you say to people in those situations?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, first of all, well done for being there, for standing there in that discomfort and that tension and trying to work with it, because many people don't last. And so if you're there and you're doing it anyway, that's awesome.
That's my first response. Within reason, as long as they're taking care of themselves and they're able to sustain it.
Yes,
in my experience, a lot of designers who put themselves through immense amounts of pain to survive in toxic organizations and toxic situations.
The toxic organization is a slight addendum, to that. But So the other thing is, I guess, have we truly understood how we are adding value to the people in front of us? Have we truly understood the levers that we, that our practice can uncover that they understand? One thing I'm observing, and you tell me what you see, is that we're very, very good at listening to customers. We are very, very terrible at listening to colleagues. We amp up the empathy dial to those people outside the organization, but many designers haven't actually sat down and done the same with their colleagues, with their seniors, with their stakeholders. So if I'm walking into an executive boardroom and all I've got is my customer insights and why we should most definitely fund another designer, I'm not going to get anywhere. I need to walk in there equipped with a really deep understanding of what the other people in the executive or the people I'm trying to influence actually want out of this conversation, what they are thinking about, what they want for their teams, how can I as a designer enable the outcomes that they are seeking. Me pushing my own agenda is maturity 4.5. Yeah. So when I think about design evolution inside organizations, the second part to your question is, how can we meet an organization where they're at? Where are the people at in their journey of profit over people to people over profit? Because if we want to create a binary, that's the journey. And so where's the organization at? And if I start harping on about human-centered design and the benefits, the customers, and how we make people's lives better, and an organizational culture that fundamentally is evidenced by, you know, every single piece of structure or artifact, anchoring and profit and productivity, I'm using the wrong language. I'm selling the wrong stories.
Yeah, I've got these people in my head when you're talking. And nearly all of them would be like, yeah, it's definitely people over profit, or no, profit over people.
Oh, yeah.
Nearly all scenarios in that outcome is the businesses favor the profit. So what do you see in terms of where we can actually work with design, or not designers, but leadership, functional leadership, to support them to become, not even become, just to be open to those situations? Because like, I've invited leaders to workshops and training and all that, and they'll come for the opening bit and then they'll drop off after 15 minutes. And that in itself just says an awful lot. They're like, yeah, okay, see you later, I'm not interested. And, you know, fair play, like in some senses, they're like, okay, this is your domain. I know if I'm here, I might kind of disrupt that. I want you to learn. But at the same time, there's a certain amount of responsibility to upskill, to be able to communicate on the language that designers create. It has to be a two-way street in order for anything to change. They are the gatekeepers at the end of the day. And is it a case of some people are going to be able to get it and others just aren't?
I mean, to your earlier point, you know, if you're in a toxic organization, no amount of goodwill and effort is, some environments cannot be changed, and it's not worth, you know, your sanity to do that.
Absolutely. They're in a toxic organization, I'm like, okay, just get out. Okay, there's other places you can go and work.
Yeah.
Just get out.
Because there are plenty of organizations who get it, right? And there are plenty of environments that are conducive to introducing designerly ways of thinking and working that can unlock increasing opportunities over time.
Yeah, I'm with leadership as a particular function, and you've got design leadership, I'm always kind of interested to hear what people have to say around what we can be doing better, what we can be doing more of to really help crystallize not even the value of design, but just be aware of the conditions that need to occur.
That's right.
Because too often it's just seen as human resources and like, okay, we just need to get another designer in and throw a design at the problem. And it's not really how most of the people who listen to this podcast want to operate. And it tends to be the blockers, the main blockers. If we're using that analogy of the chef again, a lot of the kitchens aren't fit for purpose. So What were the main pieces that you saw in the report and in the research? Because you had like bloody loads of conversations. It must have taken you months. Like I can't have more than two conversations a week without feeling dizzy on this podcast. You tried 28 of them. And what were the kind of enlightening pieces? What were the enlightening conversations that you walked away from? And you went, wow, okay, that was eye opening.
I mean, yeah, whole conversations. That's a pretty big reflection mode. I would say some of the pieces that really stood out were, and that is a massive part of my learning journey, I guess, is Indigenous perspectives on design and leadership. Yeah. And much of the evolved leadership understanding I hold as a result of this report has come from Indigenous practitioners or those who are very literate in the Indigenous space. You know, design, after all, is a Western concept that we are superimposing into many, many different environments, which in fact have had their own innovation and consultation processes and collaboration processes for centuries.
Yeah.
And so balancing that, I think, has been really, you know, or sort of reinvestigating where our practice comes from, how we talk about it, and what humility in our practice looks like, I think is a really important milestone in the evolution and maturity of the design discipline. I would say that some of the other things that, you know, when we come across these challenges that we just spoke around, how can we convince CFOs and CEOs and all that stuff, one of the big insights, again, that came from conversation was around that notion of context literacy. How much time do we spend and actively invest into observing what's going on around you? There's this wonderful book called Wayfinding Leadership that we can link to in your show notes, which has come out of the Indigenous space here, Shelley Spiller and a couple of other authors.
Okay.
And so the notion behind this is to understand that when we lead in spaces, the westernized or industrialized concept around leadership is very much sitting around going from A to B and planning our way there.
Yeah.
And then when something goes wrong, we go, oh, surprise, something didn't work out the way we planned. Luckily, we have three backup plans.
Yeah.
The notion of leadership, as I understand it, based on a more Indigenous perspective, is to suggest that in our language, we live in a VUCA world, nothing is within our control. And so the core leadership capability we must cultivate is navigation. Navigation is dependent on reading signs in the landscape.
Yeah. Right?
What signs does our landscape, our context offer us to make better decisions for our teams, for our discipline, for our people? Yeah. How much time as a leader can you afford to pull away from the BAU meetings and productivity and cadence of things and just sit there and watch what's going on? What are people saying? Why are they saying it? How are they saying it? What does it relate to? And I would say that was mirrored in all of the leaders, even if they haven't had an Indigenous background, who were successful. They were successful because they could read the landscape like it was a book. And they could hear what someone was saying and knew, okay, this is what this means for the next strategy update. They could read the next newsletter that came in the internal comms, whatever platform, and gone, oh, okay, these are the three key words I have to include in my next executive presentation. They've become so attuned to what's going on around them that they were able to use it to their advantage. And when I think about my coaching practice and my training practice with designers, the thing that stumps people up is their inability to see what's in front of them. And it's because we're not cultivating our senses to tune into what's going on around it. We are so obsessed about planning and filling out business cases and getting through the double diamond at pace with key deliverables.
Yeah.
That we don't see what we need, what we could use to actually advance our cause if we so wish.
So going back to the Indigenous perspectives, I like the fact that the heightened senses and ability to kind of simplify and identify are key aspects. What other aspects did you learn from the Indigenous perspectives around design? What other pieces came through?
I would say, I mean, there are a number of people significantly better placed to talk about this than I am.
Yeah, put it in your report.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say that the processes by which we can drive innovation or drive different outcomes are manifold. And the Indigenous, I guess, ways of driving what is akin to design outcomes are much more reliant on building relationships, on anchoring in conversation, in curating an environment of trust. Like all the stuff that we are discounting as nice to have is the stuff that is central to, the way I understand it anyway, is central to Indigenous design practice, at least in Aotearoa New Zealand. And I will also say that those working closely with the Indigenous space have largely given up the concept or the language around design for many of its challenges and at times recolonizing elements, and have embraced different frameworks such as Hotuwaka and others. That center conversation, people, and relationships. And the ironic thing is that if we want to design for people, we must center on the elements that make us human, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that is humbling and that is enriching, and I'm really, really grateful for being able to have had a tiny sneak peek into some of this. And the last thing you'll find at the end of the report, I talk about tensions that we have an opportunity to lead into or lean into. And one of the tensions that was offered that I thought was beautiful was one around the idea that design started off as a production process but can become a change process.
Yeah.
And it's not one or the other. It's a spectrum, right? It's depending on the context. Again, we're moving up and down the spectrum. But again, leadership moments are by and large occurring when we stand in spaces of tension. Every single conversation I have had has either explicitly articulated or reflected on the fact that the moments in time where their leadership was most asked of were moments of tension and challenge. And so if we want to lead design, we can't lead design in the spaces of comfort. There is no leadership to be sought there.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're coming towards the end of our conversation. I want to ask a question. It might be a little bit kind of personal in some levels, but after you've created the report, did you feel optimistic? Did you feel more optimistic about design's role in the future, or did you feel more pessimistic?
What I felt was that design as a discipline carries a promise that unites us across difference. And for me, that was really energizing. That would make me really, really hopeful. The thing that is really challenging is that we are our worst enemy. And it will take overcoming of our egos, of our hero obsession, of many of our deep held beliefs of what it means to drive change, for design to sustain and evolve into a respectful and responsive practice that it can enable and hold space for others to drive change collectively. we have some really awesome building blocks as part of this discipline. We're by no means the only people. Change is not exclusive to designers, but we're holding a unique set of composites, of skills, of mindsets that are, you know, that are leaning towards change, that are really suitable to this sort of work. But the question is, will we as individuals, as teams, and as a collective, as a discipline, step up to meet that challenge, to lean into our individual and collective leadership moments, choose them wisely, and then face the storm?
Yeah, absolutely. Sarah, listen, look, thank you so much for sitting through me kind of grilling you for the last 49 minutes. But I really enjoyed speaking and listening to the responses to my questions and stuff. I put a link to the report into the show notes, if that's all right. Is there a website that people can go to and download it?
Sure, it's sarahclearwater.com.
Okay, very good. And if people want to reach out to you and stay in touch, what's the best way for them to do that?
LinkedIn would be ideal. Otherwise, it's sarah@sarahclearwater.com.
All right, I'll put a link to your email as well. Listen, look, thank you so much for staying up late in New Zealand evening time. Hopefully you can get to bed and get a full night's sleep with your child sleeping through the night. There's my wish for you, Sarah, tonight. Listen, thanks so much for your time. I really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Jerry. It was my pleasure to talk to you.
There you go, folks. I hope you enjoyed that episode. And if you enjoyed it and want to listen to more, why not visit thisishcd.com, where you can learn more about what we're up to and also explore our courses whilst you're there. Thanks again for listening.